Session number 24917, Frederick Hunt, Reel 1.
Wireless operators in the Great War were trained by the Royal Flying Corps at their school at Farnborough before being sent out to combat zones where they were individually attached to artillery units. They were largely recruited from post office telegraphs operators, but other individuals were allowed from men of a reasonable standard of education and A1 for fitness. I joined the Army under the Derby scheme in 1915, and in due course I was called up, where sadly I was categoried C3. That was didn't suit me, as I was particularly anxious to join the wireless operators section. But fortunately I was in a position to be able to pull a few wires, and eventually in March 1917 I found myself at Farnborough at the school. The school was manned by a man for deficiency by an old regular sergeant major. And for education there were a number of officers who were mainly professionals in civil life. Discipline there was very strict, and food was rather scarce, but otherwise it was not too bad. The recruits started their education by studying the Morse code, of course, and attending lectures on wireless telegraphy in general. When a certain degree of proficiency was obtained in translating the Morse code, we were transferred to another room where there were about six telegraphic buzzers. One buzzer would be tapped out in Morse, where we had to make a mental note of the tone of that buzzer. All the others had tones slightly different. Then all the six buzzers were set buzzing away furiously, and we had to distinguish the one that we had listened to and transcribe the Morse code. Very confusing at first, but it was not long before I got accustomed to it. As I said, the discipline and the lack of food was rather wearing. I was always hungry, and I was feeling pretty miserable. And when one morning, on parade, an appeal went out for men to volunteer to pass out for overseas service, I thought to myself that it couldn't be much worse in France. Discipline probably was not so strict, and there might be more to eat. So I stepped forward. I took the exam without much difficulty, and spent the next week having an easy time, being measured for a special uniform, and being fully equipped. There was, at the end of the week, there was a notice in second class orders in the office, which announced that Air Mechanic Hunt had passed out for foreign service in 9 weeks training. That seems to have been a little a record. When the time came, I was joined a small draft of about 15 or 16 men, where we set off for France. We went down to the docks at Folkestone to embark, but was sent back to a rest house because there was a report of submarines in the channel. But after another long wait, we marched down again and re-embarked and crossed to Boulogne, accompanied by a destroyer on each side of us. We climbed up to the Boulogne Heights in sweltering heat, spent the night, and next day we were sent on our way to Saint-Omer, the first air depot. We spent about a week there, engaged on various duties such as loading coal from barges and all sorts of things, erecting a marquee after a night's pouring rain, which was no fun and very, very unkind to the fingernails. Working with us were German prisoners. We worked from 7 to 8 at night. The German prisoners worked from 8:30 to 4. But after a while, I was taken in an army tender, accompanied by an officer, to Vlamertinge, where I was attached to the 81st Heavy Artillery Group. It wasn't long before I realised that I did a good thing by volunteering to pass out, because I'd been appointed to a very fine unit, the Colonel Le Pellet. Was a thorough gentleman, although a disciplinarian, and the regimental sergeant major, Reeves, was a father to us. As regards the other officers, we were not concerned, but we were not subject to discipline from them, as we were attached men. For the time, things were quiet, but the artillery was working up to ready for the third Battle of Ypres on the 31st of July, and we were kept busy recording the calls that came in. We had a small dugout, though not a very safe one, together with two RE men, both mature men. Things went on quite happily until I began to think that war wasn't too bad, until one day a high velocity shell fell in the middle of a bunch of Pioneer Corps men just not far from the dugout. All the casualties were taken past the dugout in full view of us. I felt pretty horrible. But I got accustomed to it, and we carried on, not for long. We moved on to Elverdinge and had a nice little billet in a pigsty. It even had a little window. From there we moved on to Regensburg Chateau in the suburbs of Ypres. We were lucky enough to have an upper room there, very comfortable, a nice large window with a good view. We obtained that, I gather, because the officers preferred the dugouts. Things went along pretty easily, except for that every day about 12 o'clock the Germans lobbed a large armor-piercing shell about 100 yards from us. I don't know what they were after, but I imagine it was after the chateau. Every time it fell, there was a pause, and then an almighty upheaval, which caused the whole chateau to shake. I was told after we left, about a fortnight after we left, it did eventually hit the chateau. I must tell you now about our work. The Mark IV receiver measured about 16 inches by 8 inches tall. The vital point was at two Peregrine crystals in light contact with each other. To obtain best signals, one had to find the point of contact which gave the best benefit. There were two dials, the aerial circuit dial and the condenser dial. In searching for signals, one had to keep the aerial circuit dial constantly turning. If an important signal was detected, or one of importance to the battery, one would then turn the condenser dial to get to the maximum volume. Outside, there was an earth mat consisting of an 8-foot gauze copper wire to get to the necessary earth. The aerial mast was 30 feet in length, consisting of six 5-foot steel tubes loosely socketed in each other, held erect by four guy ropes. This was a two-man job. At first trial it was a nightmare, but later two experienced men could erect the mast complete in less than a minute. The operator had a number of 8-foot American cloth, white American cloth strips. American cloth, of course, is the forerunner of plastics, which he was able to use to lay out on the ground in form of letters, our only contact with the plane. The observer plane was usually an RE-8 biplane, operated by a pilot and a rear gunner. The pilot sat sitting forward and the rear gunner behind him, back to back with a Lewis gun. The pilot had a small buzzer or spark set operated by a 6-volt battery, and his aerial consisted of a 30-foot copper flex wire with a lead weight at the end. This could be reeled out so that it trailed below the plane in order to give signals. To get the best volume, the pilot had to fly directly towards the receiving station. The next best result was in flying directly away. If he flew crosswise, the signals were almost inaudible. His job was to search the sky mainly for foreign aircraft and for possible targets like batteries firing. When he could send out a code message, NF, batteries firing, or any other target, and giving the map reading for any battery who happened to be not engaged to join in and attack the target. There were occasional pre-arranged shoots which when that was for concentration on a specific target, by pre-arrangement the observer would fly over the target area, detect his target, take the map reading. He would then call up the battery arranged to give the call in code, "Are you receiving me?" The operator would then put out a strip according to a letter T, which meant "We are receiving you." The pilot would then give the map reading and allow time for the operator to inform the battery commander, who could then find the target on his map and instruct the gunners to lay the guns accordingly with the correct elevation and deflection. As soon as that was ready, the operator would put out another letter, letter F, which means "We are ready to fire." The pilot would then send the signal dot dot dash fire. The message would be transferred to the battery commander. He would give the order and the battery would open fire. The observer would then observe the result of the shots and register them according to an imaginary clock face, the target being the center of the clock. The far distance would be 12 o'clock or north, the nearest point 6 o'clock or south. He then had imaginary circles, concentric circles, at specific distances, 10 yards A, letter A, 20 yards, letter B, 50 yards, letter C, and so on. According to the position of the shots fired, he could then give the result. If, for instance, it was 20 yards to direct left, or that would he would give B9 or B at 9 o'clock, and so on. That would be repeated until the battery was able to plant their shells on the target. So the operator, the pilot, would then give the signal MOK, mostly OK, and returning to squadron. Yes. Unfortunately, it didn't always go like that. On one occasion, when I was attached to 266 battery, 6-inch howitzers, at Irish Farm, we had arranged to shoot on a battery. The preparations had been made. The gunners had the correct target, and the pilot then said, "Are you ready to fire?" But at that moment, a German spotter plane appeared, dithering around. The battery commander, of course, was very unloath to give his position away, so he held fire for a time. The pilot, unfortunately, hadn't noticed it and went on calling fire, fire. I think he must have been rather nervous. Eventually he signaled no reply from battery, return it to squadron. The commander then gave way and gave the order to fire. The battery continued until the shoot was finished. But the spotter plane had done its job. That night, the battery was plastered all night with high explosive and gas shells. I was fortunately placed. My little dugout was on a sloping side of a hill, protected by about a 3-foot square entrance with a sheet of hessian hung over it, which gave partial protection from the gas as it drifted down the hill. I sat up until 2:30 in the morning, but the firing was still going on. I laid down with my gas mask on, trying to sleep, but it was too uncomfortable. After a while, I gave up. I took my gas mask off and promptly fell asleep. In the morning, I woke about at 7 o'clock. Apart from feeling pretty miserable and rather sick, I wasn't too badly off. But when I looked out, I found that a lot of the gunners had been taken out by stretcher. I reported sick and was excused duty for a few hours, but was soon back on duty again. And none the worse, except that for a chronic state of chronic catarrh, which I still have with me. From there, we moved on to Admiral's Road, just in front of Polka Powell. We started off, it was a distance of about 3 miles. We stopped for a rest on the way, that is, by a little carrying party with the masts and equipment. When we moved on, I stupidly left my greatcoat and ground sheet behind, and as soon as I remembered, I had to leave them, go back and collect it. By that time, it was practically dark. And as I walked along the duckboard, the Germans began dropping overhead high explosive shells, Jack Johnson's, which gave me a rather terrifying journey, the end of which, in the pitch darkness, I stepped off a duckboard that wasn't there and went into a shell hole half full of water. I had no idea where I was, but my shouts for help eventually brought voices in the distance, "Where are you?" And by a lot of fumbling around, hands met, I was hauled out, and I was glad to discover that we were already at the battery. I slept all night, crowded in a Nissen hut full of other men, with my knees drawn up under my chin. I was surprised in the morning to discover that, despite the immersion in the shell hole, my feet and legs were quite dry, which was a tribute to the army putties, which were very efficient. My station was in a shallow communication trench covered by a section of elephant iron, that is curved corrugated iron, with a few sandbags about 100 yards from the guns. Between us there were two communication trenches covered with barbed wire. I sat there from dawn till dusk every day listening in, except for two breaks when I had to make my way across the trenches down to the cookhouse to collect my meal. By the time I had scrambled back across those two trenches and reached my station, my Dixie was usually half empty. Shelling was intense. My aerial mast was blown down several times, and I had to call for assistance from a gunner to help re-erect it. This went on for about a fortnight, and by that time I was feeling very miserable. My ears were bleeding from the pressure of the earphones, listening in from dawn till dusk, for that time was 4:30 in the morning until 9:00 at night. And I began to wonder how much longer I could stick this with no one to speak to, when suddenly in the trench one morning appeared two legs followed by the body of Lieutenant Elgood, wireless operator, who braved the shell fire when the visiting corporal who should have come had funked it. His first words were, "I don't like that." That referred to my insulated leading, which had been tied with a piece of string loosely to the edge of the elephant iron to prevent it blowing about. I knew he was right, because in theory when that string got damp it would pass signals down to earth through the elephant iron. Anyway, after that he relented and said, "Oh," I produced a bunch of letters, and he says, "Oh, here's some letters from home for you. And how's it, what's it like here?" I told him in very precise terms what it was like. He paused and he said, "You know, you're not doing much good here." I quite agree. I said there was no question of aerial signals, because it was just blind shooting by the Germans on open sights. He said, "I think I can get you back to the troops soon." I could have kissed that man. He was as good as his word. 2 days later, I was back at the group. We moved down to the Alice area a few days later and camped in Tolloy Wood, about 3.5 kilos in front of Alice, where we spent a hard but peaceful winter under the ice and snow until March 1918.